from bureaus worldwide. This is FSN.
Yeah, the US is full of shit. The walrus himself, John Bolton, and idiot-in-chief, Mike Pompeo. Venezuela. Viva Venezuela. Venezuela will be all right. Thanks, Ollie. This is Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. It's March 12th, 2019. And, of course, my name is Richie Allen. Welcome to the show.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Got a really good show for you today. Coming up in the second hour, retired police detective John Wedger will be back on the program. The independent inquiry into child sex abuse is hearing allegations about prominent paedophiles, prominent meaning establishment figures around Westminster, and that is ongoing at the moment. It's very important. We'll speak with John in hour two about that. Before that, though, there will be a bit of Brexit reporting, and Christopher Monckton, Lord Monckton of Brenchley, will join the programme in about 20 minutes' time, ahead of the vote on Theresa May's deal, or the deal Theresa May negotiated with the European Union, the withdrawal agreement. It was hammered by over 200 votes, 230 in fact, in January. It goes before MPs tonight. It's expected to be defeated again. We'll talk about the implications of that with Christopher Monckton this hour, live on Fab Radio 2, TriggerWarning.tv, my website, Cogent Radio, Tune In Radio as well. It is your Richie Allen Show. And of course, I'm on Twitter, and I've got Twitter open right now, so join right in if you want. Yeah, you mightn't want to join in, but do if you want. The Brexit betrayal. Now, today, I think, will be the day that might be enshrined in history. It might be the day that's March 12th, 2019, when it finally dawned on, I think this is the dawning today, 17,410,000 people who voted to leave the European Union 2.5 years ago, nearly 3 years ago. I think today is the day that they realised they were stiffed. I think so. Thing is, of course, what will they do now? Nada. Niente. Not a sausage. I think. Theresa May was in Strasbourg last night, and at a press conference there, she said she had legally binding assurances from the European Union that the UK even would not be trapped in the backstop. "I have changes to the withdrawal agreement," said May, as her nose grew at a rate of knots. "Changes," she said, "that mean we can leave the backstop when we want." She was lying. This is the crux of it. The statement, this, you have to listen to this because it's a wee bit complicated. And I'm nobody's dummy, but I'm no Alfred Einstein either. If you get my drift. Albert Einstein, of course. Right. So I'll try and explain it for you. What did the statement issued by the UK and the EU say last night? Well, it claimed to have given us added legal reassurance that both sides intend that the backstop plan for the Irish border, if it's ever used, would only be a temporary measure. But in fact, dear listener, there is no legal assurance whatsoever, because the European Union only repeated last night what it said back in January. Because in January, as was reported here, the EU sent a letter to May, signed by Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the European Commission, and the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk. So they're only repeating what they said. This document, one of three, is just another layer of reassurance. It isn't worth the paper it's printed on. The text of the backstop itself hasn't changed, meaning there's no guaranteed end date and there is no unilateral exit mechanism agreed by both sides. The backstop, was put in place in the event that there is no agreement between the UK and the EU, and to prevent a hard border in Ireland, the backstop means keeping the European Union as a whole in a temporary customs union, right? In other words, keeping us in the European Union. Okay, two other documents have been agreed that mean sweet Fanny Adams. I'll tell you those. A joint statement that commits both sides to try to develop technological solutions for the Irish border by 2020. And thirdly, a unilateral UK statement which sets out the government's interpretation of how it could eventually exit the backstop if the European Union acts in bad faith. This is hilarious, this one. This is quite funny. This will make you laugh your ass off. May says, we can exit the backstop if the European Union is acting in bad faith. Again, arse, feck, balls, nonsense. Here's the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, May's frontbench colleague, and in the government, the most senior legal figure. Here he is blowing May out of the water.
Mr. Speaker, let me say frankly what, in my opinion, these documents do not do. They are not about a situation where, despite the parties properly fulfilling the duties of good faith and best endeavours, they cannot reach an agreement on a future relationship. Such an event, in my opinion, is highly unlikely to occur, and it is both in the interests of the UK and the EU to agree a future relationship as quickly as possible.
So Cox is saying there that the bad faith clause, where the UK could say, well, we're leaving the backstop because the EU has acted in bad faith. Cox is saying there, well, I don't think that's likely to happen because I believe that the UK and the EU both want to get a deal. That's crap. But technically, I suppose, crap or not, Cox is entitled to think it or to believe it. But listen to what he says next.
Were such a situation to occur, however, let me make it clear.
Right, so were a situation to occur, were the UK to think, we've got to leave the backstop because the European Union is acting in bad faith. Let me be clear, says Cox. What does he say next?
The legal risk, as I set it out in my letter of the 13th of November, remains unchanged.
That's it. The legal risk remains unchanged. There might be nothing you can do about it. You might be stuck in the backstop forever. Right?
The question for the House is whether, in the light of these improvements, as a political judgment, the House should now enter into those arrangements.
And that's what they're doing a bit later on. Explaining what happened very well is rabid Remainer Hilary Benn, whose father was a great Eurosceptic, regardless of what you think of Tony Benn. And he must be turning in his grave. But Hilary Benn does well in splaining just what's happened. Listen to what he says very, very carefully.
There is no unilateral exit mechanism for the United Kingdom. There is no time limit. And while it may be possible to suspend the backstop, in order to do that, we, the United Kingdom, have to persuade the arbitration panel that we have a case. We have to persuade the arbitration panel, if it's then going to turn from suspension into disapplication, that the reason for the problem is that there is a lack of good faith on the part of the European Union. I think it's pretty safe to say, Mr. Speaker, the EU would say, no, it's not a lack of bad faith. We just don't think your alternative arrangements work because we think they would undermine the integrity of the single market of the customs union. The moment they say that, then that engages questions of the application of EU law, at which point the panel has to refer the matter to the Court of Justice of the European Union, whose judgment on those questions will be binding on everyone.
What? What did Hilary Benn just say there? Did you hear that bit there?
The EU would say, no, it's not a lack of bad faith. We just don't think your alternative arrangements work because we think they would undermine the integrity of the single market of the customs union. The moment they say that, then that engages questions of the application of EU law, at which point the panel has to refer the matter to the Court of Justice of the European Union, whose judgment on those questions will be binding on everyone.
Ah, so if the UK says in the future about the backstop, we want to leave it because the European Union is acting in bad faith, the arbitration panel would end up referring the matter to the European Court of Justice?
What kind of fuckery is this?
it's proper fuckery, actually. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave, really. That's it. Why do we do it? Why do we waste our time explaining to people what should be as clear as the nose on the end of their face? May is saying, if we think they act in bad faith in the future, we can stop, remove the backstop and say the EU is acting in bad faith, and we'll take that to the European Court of Justice, the ECJ. We're going nowhere is where we're going. It's as simple as that. It's all a bit surreal, really, for me. So I've told you what the backstop is. An arrangement to keep an open border on the island of Ireland if all else failed. And it's bullshit. There's no need for it. It's fear-mongering. The European Union said the backstop was necessary because of the history in Ireland, the conflict and the Good Friday Agreement. If implemented, the backstop means that, as I said, the whole of the UK stays in a customs union with the European Union. There's no need for it. What happens if Theresa May loses again tonight? We'll have an election, according to Charles Walker, MP. Here he is on Sky News.
Well, I can't see how we look past a general election if the deal doesn't get through this evening. A government that can't get its legislation passed, particularly at this historic time in our country, our country's future, is it has to go and seek a mandate from somewhere. We know what the Prime Minister wants to happen, and it is just impossible to imagine that if it doesn't go through tonight, that a general election doesn't hove into view very, very quickly.
It's like Tories or turkeys voting for Christmas. That's just a vehicle going by. They're supporting something or other. There we go.
I'm not saying I want a general election.
But what are you saying?
I'm saying it'll just happen. You can't go on like this. We cannot have a parliament that can't come to a decision. Most of my colleagues stood on a manifesto to deliver Brexit, and now about 400, 350 are determinedly making sure Brexit doesn't happen. So parliament is failing in its duty to come to a decision.
You think? What about Moggy, old Jacob Rees-Mogg, Moggy? He had a cosy chat with R.K. Burley too, and amazingly wouldn't commit the European Research Group. That's a group of conservatives that are in favour of leaving with no deal. Leaving properly, right? Leaving. The ERG. Amazingly, when speaking with K. Burley, Jacob Rees-Mogg would not commit the ERG to either vote against May's deal or to abstain, which was kind of strange.
Oh, well, we've got a meeting at 5 o'clock where the ERG will discuss it and come to a final decision. I'd be surprised if many people wanted to abstain on an issue of this importance.
OK, but you're not voting as a pack, are you? You're not voting as a group. You're voting individually. How are you going to vote? You must know how you feel.
Well, I know how I feel, but I'm waiting to discuss it with my friends and members of the ERG to see where we are going, what the arguments are, and listen to what people have to say. So, unusually, I haven't yet made a decision.
OK, so what does the ERG have to say in order to convince you that you should either abstain or vote with the Prime Minister?
Well, I don't think abstention's a realistic prospect. This is a really important vote on the future of the nation, and I think MPs will want to make up their minds one way or another. The only reason for voting for the deal, which remains a bad deal, not just for the backstop, but for other reasons too, is the fear that if the deal is voted down, then we might not leave the European Union, that the whole prospect of leaving is in threat. That would be the one thing that would change people's minds, but I don't think that is the case.
Yeah, there might be quite a few Conservatives in favour of leaving, generally in favour of leaving properly, who might absolutely wet themselves tonight and vote for May, because they're terrified that if they don't vote for May, they won't get any type of Brexit ever. But the deal is absolutely shit. The deal is actually worse than staying in the European Union, as we've outlined I don't know how many times before. Barley then, the ginger ninja, says, well, maybe Theresa May's deal is better than the chaos of leaving without one. And Barley brings up car companies. Car companies leaving because of their fears about no deal. And to be fair to Mog, he does a bit better here.
Okay, so what's going on with all these car companies that have decided to leave or are concerned about leaving, suggesting that they may leave, some of them are already going, suggesting that they may leave if there's a problem with Brexit on the 29th of March and there isn't a deal? Are they scaremongering too?
Just-in-time delivery takes place across borders other than the EU border. Bear in mind, Honda received a lot of just-in-time inventory from Japan, so it's not a question that relates exclusively to the European Union. And the car companies have all sorts of other problems relating not least to diesel engines. And in that, the EU has been part of the problem rather than the solution, because it's the EU that fiddled the emissions tests to encourage diesel engines. So actually, it's not a particular Brexit problem, it's a car industry problem. The other thing to remember is that the British government...
Mr. Rees-Mogg, is it? I mean, some of them are saying that there of course are issues with diesel emissions, but some of them are specifically citing problems with Brexit, including BMW.
Well, what are these problems? There is no change to just-in-time delivery. Just-in-time delivery is knowing when things leave and when they arrive, and is done across borders other than the European Union. The clearance time for components coming through Southampton from outside the EU is 6 seconds. So there is no delay caused by not being inside the European Union. If that's their real problem, it's not a problem, it's a phantom problem. The real issue is the increased taxation put on new cars a couple of years ago and the problems around diesel engines.
So they're scaremongering?
Well, those are your words. I think they are raising problems that will turn out not to be real ones.
No, it's a question. They're not my words. It's not a statement, Mr. Rees-Mogg, with all due respect, but it is a question.
It sounded as if it had ended with...
Barley really is a fishwife, isn't she? Look up the definition of fishwife if you don't understand what it is.
It sounded as if it had ended with a full stop rather than a question mark. I apologise for misinterpreting your grammar.
Not at all.
But scaremongering is not a word I would choose to use. I think they are raising problems, as businesses are entitled to do, that will turn out not to be real problems.
Jacob Rees-Mogg. The vote is at 7. May is expected to lose, but not lose as badly as back in January. I must point out that some of our eagle-eyed listeners are saying that, do you remember a few days ago those letter bombs that didn't harm anyone were sent to various places in London, transport hubs and that? Apparently, the new IRA has claimed responsibility for this. I say apparently, because a lot of people are very sceptical and believe that this particular thing, this alleged act of terrorism, is all part of a plan to scare people more and more into moving towards either a second referendum or just giving up the whole idea of Brexit altogether. So a number of our listeners are saying they see that as some sort of false flag. And I have to say, dear listeners, I understand why you think that, and I wouldn't rule it out, to be honest with you. Genuinely, the timing of it is very suspicious, to say the least. Liz tweets, is it not time for the ginger ninja to retire? Nah, Liz, we're stuck with her for a few more years yet. To be honest, I'd miss her. Faisal tweets, so a small group of Tories who support leaving properly without a deal, in other words, what the UK public voted for in an official referendum, yes. Paul tweets, we may very well be going nowhere, but at least the tunes are good. And don't get me started on Hillary, let's bomb Syria. Ben, total system sycophant and good doggy, someone who's about as credible as Tony Blair. And David tweets, I'd have been more shocked if the UK actually left. Yes, David, that makes two of us. So would I. But then I never expected it to happen. Murray tweets, there is absolutely no difference in what may brought back to the already scuppered vote. It will be interesting enough, I suppose, at around about 7 p.m. tonight. Rich tweets, Richie, today is the day democracy was exposed as bullshit. Not to me and you, Rich. Not to me and you, pal. But maybe to others. Davopamsky, how you doing, mate? Tweets, Richie, today I saw Jean-Claude Juncker drunker in front of May say either accept the deal or no Brexit. They have total contempt for us and our decision and don't even try to hide it. The evil feckers, says Davopamsky. Thanks, mate, for your tweet. I really appreciate that. Let's welcome back to the programme then a man who's no stranger to you, conservative political commentator, former UKIP candidate, often seen on television talking about these matters. Is he there yet? He's not. He's fashionably late. We might have to take a tune. I was in the process of interviewing Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, but I don't think he's answered yet, has he? He's not, actually, no. That wouldn't be the first time, so we might have to take a tune. 23 and a half minutes. In fact, it's just approaching 24 minutes past the hour, past five, as we talk live. Let's have some music then while we dial up Christopher Monckton on the Richie Allen Show. Do keep those tweets coming in. We're taking a completely different direction in the second hour of the programme, where I will be speaking about the IICSA, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse. Hopefully Chris Monckton next, after this from the Smashing Pumpkins on your Richie Allen Show. Right, we've got the technicality sorted out. That was the Smashing Pumpkins. Let's welcome back Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, Christopher Monckton himself. Christopher, welcome back to the programme.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Richie.
You're a gentleman, sir. Thanks for doing it. I know you're in a lot of demand today. Christopher, we're never, ever leaving the European Union, are we?
Well, you got that one right. I think we were saying this last time round. I mean, what they're trying to do now is the following. Number one, they've done this cobbled up attempt at making it look as though the backstop isn't a backstop, and therefore that we're not locked in forever. People are not buying that. The European Research Group has made it very plain that they will be voting against the deal. The DUP will do the same. So the deal is going down today. The next thing that will happen is there will then be a vote on whether the Parliament wants to countenance no deal. Parliament will vote no to that. Then they will be immediately asked, and I suspect they'll be asked this tomorrow as well, whether they therefore wish Theresa May to apply for an extension of the Article 50 period. They will say yes to that. She will then ask for an extension, which will be vetoed and by the European Union. And then what will happen is she will then say, well, since Parliament has voted that we can't have a deal, the only option I'm left with is unilaterally to withdraw Britain's application to leave the European Union.
Wow.
So that's how it's going to go.
So you think the European Union would decline an offer from the UK government to extend Article 50?
Well, the bureaucrats would like that, but the Spain will veto it. I think Hungary will veto it and Poland as well, possibly. So I think there's quite a good chance that will be vetoed. So that then the choice is between us going out with a no-deal Brexit, which would actually be far and away the best option for Britain anyway, save us 49 billion straight off, and then we wouldn't have to have all the humiliation of all the other provisions other than the backstop, as well as the backstop in Theresa May's ghastly capitulation to the European Union. All that wouldn't happen. But if the choice is between no deal with the temporary disruption here and there only that would entail, which Parliament is terrified of because, you know, they've never done anything like this before. Most MPs just have no idea of how international trade negotiations go. So they're all pathetically terrified of no deal. So they will obviously, when they veto no deal, that will leave Theresa May only with one option, which is to withdraw once the European Union has vetoed it, the application to leave the European Union. And that's what she's been playing for all along.
The implications, Christopher.
Brexit, it never has.
It never has. If that happened, I'm getting you can imagine, I'm getting dozens and dozens of tweets. This is a live radio program.
Yeah.
People are expressing absolute horror. People are saying, I'll never vote again. What are the implications for democracy? Are we going to... We had a great chat last time, you and I, about what the people could do in the event this happened. What are the implications?
I think that what we're not good at in Britain is so-called civil disobedience, you know, not paying our taxes, refusing to comply with any of the government's instructions. We're not good at that. And there's always been a feeling that to do anything like that in a democracy is somehow treasonous, which, of course, it is. But when you have a democracy that's broken down to the extent that Parliament decides its only way out of the, you know, the long-standing row over whether we should be a totalitarian state governed by an alien communist entity or whether we should be some kind of democracy, and Parliament itself can't decide whether we should be a totalitarian state or a democracy, and therefore it says, right, we'll ask the people to decide that. The people then decide that, and Parliament says, oh, you got the decision wrong. We wanted totalitarianism, and so we're going to have totalitarianism. In those circumstances, democracy itself has broken down in about the most fundamental way possible. You ask the British people what they want. By the largest vote ever on any subject or election ever held in Britain, they vote to leave the European Union, and Parliament then thwarts that in collaboration with the government and the ghastly commissars of the European communist superstate. And of course, the people are not going to be pleased about that. However, if we are arguing for democracy, what we have to do is to exercise our disobedience to the totalitarian will of the elite by saying, right, we are going to have to set up another party. We're going to have to stand in the European elections, which of course will then be possible. And we'll stand for Nigel Farage's Brexit party, which will be a very straightforward party with one thing and one thing only on the agenda, that we will leave the European Union whether they like it or not. And so everybody who wants Brexit is now going to have to back Nigel Farage's Brexit party, because unfortunately UKIP has rather blown it by getting into bed with the extremists of the English Defence League, which wasn't a good idea. So we're all embarrassed by that. But Nigel saw that one coming, stepped aside in very good time, and is at the moment busy setting up his Brexit party. And we must all join that. That's the first thing. It's not terribly expensive. The website, I understand, isn't quite working as well as it should yet, but it is working, so you can give a try. Join Nigel Farage's Brexit party. I mean, he has shown the most commendable leadership throughout. Let's be very clear. It was he who got us the vote on Brexit, and he got us it pretty much single-handed. And so if he says, right, chaps, we're going to need a Brexit party, let's get on with it, then I think we should all stand behind him. There's no point in trying to do anything with the Conservative Party, because that has now become just another left-wing totalitarian party. It's not quite as left-wing as Communist Labour under John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn and creatures of that ilk, but it is nevertheless a totalitarian party now. It's no longer a democratic party, and therefore we need a party that stands up for making sure that in a democracy it is the will of the voters and not of the elite that shall prevail.
Very interesting this. The irony, of course, about Corbyn and McDonnell is that were they genuine socialists, as they claim to be, you, of course, would have a lot of ideological debates and disagreements with them. But if they were genuine socialists, they would have campaigned very hard to leave the European Union. We've had this discussion, you and I, before. But as they are social democrats, this hysterical kind of progressive movement that we've seen emerge, they're basically flip-floppers.
And Corbyn is an out-and-out communist, and he stands on every platform that does down the West. I mean, he's been with the PLO, the IRA, you know, every Hamas, every nasty terrorist group that blows up British people. Corbyn is there cheering for them and sharing a platform with them. I mean, let us be very clear. The security risk of allowing a communist like Corbyn and a communist like John McDonnell, and they're open communists, so they don't conceal the fact that they're communists, to become leaders of this country would be a disaster. They're not any kind of socialist. They are out and out communists, and they have no place in the government of the United Kingdom. So voting Labour in the present circumstances is simply lunacy. The first people who suffer from communism are the working class people, because communism has always said we stand for the proletariat, hammers and sickles are our symbol, etc., etc. But actually, it's the proletariat that gets shafted. The working, honest people who go out and earn the living the rest of us live by, the communists will always do them down first and worst. So if working people are thinking of voting Labour, my advice to them is don't.
Chris, let me defend
him. I can't say that you should vote Conservative.
No,
either,
no, of course.
The Conservative Party is no longer Conservative.
Listen, he's not here to defend himself, but let me say something which I believe, briefly. Don't interrupt me just for a second, and then you can have the floor. Corbyn isn't here to defend himself. Invited on this programme when he was running for the leadership, but declined to come on. I have a lot of time, me personally, for the Palestinian people. I had a lot of sympathy as a Catholic.
So do I, but I don't have any.
No, no, let me finish. No, I understand.
That, to represent them.
You promise not to interrupt me. Just let me finish.
Yeah.
I have a lot of time for the Palestinians. I have a lot of time for the struggle of nationalists and Catholics in the Republic of Ireland. Now, excuse me, in Northern Ireland. That being said, Hamas represented, were the political representation of the Palestinian people. Sinn Féin were the political representation of the nationalists in Northern Ireland. Now, I know that Sinn Féin were intertwined with the IRA. I have no problem, personally, with Corbyn romancing and whining and dining these groups back in the 80s and 90s when nobody else wanted to talk to them. So I admire Corbyn for that. And I'm going to admit this. At the same time, I have no time for violence. None whatsoever. But I admire Corbyn for speaking with people that the establishment, funnily enough now, Christopher, eventually agreed to talk to years after Corbyn was talking to them.
He was a pioneer there, to be fair to him. Shared a platform with them and then said, those elements in your organisations that are terrorist are unacceptable and you must no longer pursue terrorist methods, that would have been a different thing. But he made it very plain at those meetings that he was going along with the terrorism. That isn't acceptable.
I'm not sure about that, Chris.
The former head of the British Security Service has said in an article in a major national newspaper that to have Corbyn as Prime Minister would be one of the biggest threats to the security and safety of the people of this country that has ever been seen. And for
I don't agree with that.
The security services normally have an absolute rule of not intervening in that way in politics at all. For the no less than the former head of the security service to come out and say that shows how deeply concerned the intelligence community is at the notion of having the present Labour Party anywhere near office.
So well, maybe Israel, clear, Christopher.
If
Christopher.
You love this country and you don't want terrorists ruling the roost here, you do not, repeat not, vote Labour.
Let me say this and then I'll give you the final word on that and then we'll go back to Brexit. I would imagine the intelligence agency saying that Corbyn is a big risk. I would imagine our intelligence agencies are very heavily influenced by the Israeli ones. The Israelis can't stand Corbyn. So I wouldn't be surprised if UK intelligence agencies are saying Corbyn would be a big security risk to the UK. I wouldn't be surprised if that was because they were being egged on to say that by Corbyn's enemies in Tel Aviv. Final word on that to you, and then we'll talk about Brexit.
Right, I'll answer that one. The one thing that you can rely upon about the British intelligence services, other than the communists who you know, like Blunt and co, who were working against our interests, are that they are British first and foremost, and they do not, I mean, they work with other intelligence agencies on various matters when and where they can. And whether they have worked with with Mossad, I cannot say. What I can say is that they would certainly not take their policy cue on a matter like this from Mossad. That would be a complete misconception of their role. There's no way that the former head of the security services would be told by the Israelis, you've got to stop Corbyn. He would not entertain any such conversation. And from what I know of Mossad, they wouldn't dream of making any such suggestion. It just doesn't work that way. I'm sorry. So let us be very clear. If you love this country and you do not want terrorists ruling the roost here, you do not vote Labour. Labour is now an active danger to the security of this country, and that is why the head of the security service came out and said so.
Here's a quick question for you on that. Love having you on, because you and I disagree. We do so like gentlemen. We can do that. Sadly lacking, Christopher, in the UK mainstream media today. We don't get debates with people that have respect for one another's opinion. What about the fact that we sell the Saudis weapons to bomb thousands of Yemenis to death with? What about the fact that this country has supplied arms weapons and technology to jihadists in Syria and elsewhere. Surely the UK is a terrorist state?
No, I don't think that works. I do question some of the places we've sold weapons to, including Saudi Arabia, which, among other things, using the muscle that those weapons give it, have been spreading the very extreme, very dangerous Wahhabist form of Islam throughout the world and have caused enormous problems as a result. They have ended up indirectly sponsoring terrorism. And certainly the rather murky business of trying to support our own arms manufacture by selling arms to organizations of that sort. And of course, we were arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the communists there and so forth. It does raise many rather serious questions. And I agree with you that our policy of allowing arms sales without being really clear as to who the end users are going to be and what they're going to do with them has been a disfiguring policy of governments of all stamps over the last 30 years. And I do think that ought to be brought much more into the light of day than it has. But that is not to say that just because we have sold arms to people that we frankly shouldn't have sold arms to under governments of all stamps, therefore we should countenance a government which has actively shared platforms with terrorist groups without making it clear that it disapproves of terrorism.
Yeah, I think so you're a bit generous there to the UK government, to be honest.
Mr. Corbyn has been on the spot many times and asked to condemn various forms of terrorism around the world and has been very reluctant to do so. So I'm sorry, but he really is a danger to the security of this country. He would be a ghastly prime minister. I mean, he's too old and decrepit anyway, putting another point.
Too old and decrepit? You're about the same age as him, Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, and you could stand for election.
Ah, but I am youthful, both in mind and body, and I'm a quite different thing. You've got a very strong opinion about Corbyn.
I don't agree with it.
I'm afraid the security implications of a Labour victory in an election any time at the moment under its present constitution with the so-called Momentum Group, which is a traditional communist entryist front group, having got in and taken over all the constituencies so that more and more hardline left-wing communists are being returned under the guise of being so-called Social Democrat Labour MPs. The Labour Party in its present guise, more or less from top to bottom, is no longer a Social Democrat Party. It is a socialist party, red in tooth and claw. It is an international...
I wish it was, but I don't agree that it is.
Red in tooth and claw, and it must not gain any support from working class voters. Let the academics vote for Labour because they are all communists now. Let the Hampstead thinkers and people who live in expensive houses in London vote Labour because they are all communists now. But let the working people of Britain, who in my experience have never been communists and have never had any sympathy with communism, let them not vote Labour, because in voting Labour they will be voting communist. They will be voting directly against.
Let me back in briefly, Chris. Don't interrupt me now. Let me back in briefly. I don't interrupt you. I've heard Corbyn over the years condemn violence, no matter who does it. I've heard him condemn nationalist violence. I think the media plays up this myth, this mythology that he's never condemned it. And I like somebody who says, well, listen, we've got to talk to people. If there's an armed struggle going on somewhere, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. I'd like to talk to him. But rather than go around and around and around on that, I want to say one thing to you, and then we've got to get back to Brexit. I think you're being very generous to the UK government in saying that we sell arms to people and we don't know how they're going to be used. Christopher, I'm not blowing smoke up your backside. You're a very, very intelligent man. You cannot believe that we give the weapons, and not only the weapons, but the officers to stand in the control rooms in Riyadh, and that we don't know that Yemeni men, women and children are going to be blown to pieces. That's terrorism, Christopher. Final word on that to you.
Well, no,
60
no, you can't
we
get away with that.
I can't. It is terrorism.
The started long after we'd been supplying arms to Saudi Arabia. They then put the arms to uses we wouldn't have wished them to do. And one of the problems with selling arms to anyone is that that's the kind of thing that happens. So, you know, we've got to live slightly in the real world here. But I do think that that whole policy of selling arms to dubious regimes overseas does need a pretty thorough re-examination. I've agreed with you on that.
Shouldn't say that. Yeah, let's get back to Brexit. Right, here we are. It's coming up for 16 minutes to the top of the hour. Christopher Monckton is live on the line. Great to have Christopher back. Hereditary peer, political advisor, former UKIP candidate. And we're looking at 7 o'clock for a vote, the second vote on a meaningful vote for the second time on May's withdrawal agreement with the European Union. We're expecting it to fail. Christopher thinks quite intriguingly that when we get to the place in 2 days' time where MPs are voting on whether or not to extend Article 50, that the European Union would actually veto that and say no, because they're in such a position of power, Christopher, at that stage, that they know at that stage that the game is up. So they don't have to allow an extension, basically.
That's right. They know that if they don't allow an extension, Theresa May, having got Parliament to vote against a no-deal Brexit, will have only one option, which is to say, in that case, we won't have Brexit at all.
Yeah.
That's what she has been playing for right from the start. She's been working with elements in other parties, notably the SNP, to make sure that this is brought about. You remember that last time we discussed that funny SNP court case in Europe to make sure that she has the right unilaterally to say, OK, we'll cancel Brexit. And even though the treaty very explicitly says she can't do that, she's now got that right, because the European so-called Court of So-Called Justice trumps all our own courts. They've said she can do that. So that's all been already lined up, as I told you last time. And so now everything that she has planned right from the start, along with the European Union, when she goes to see Mr. Juncker, they sit there and they have a glass of whiskey and they chuckle to themselves as they plan the next phase of making sure that Brexit doesn't happen at all. And she has behaved in a contemptible fashion. The Conservative Party will not survive this, if you want my guess. I think they're going to fall apart, because we cannot have totalitarians like Theresa May spitting in the face of the electorate in the way that she has. And that's why I think the only hope, once she has cancelled Brexit by this cunning plan that has been unfolding over the months, which I've been telling you about, as each step of it comes to pass, you can see what the next one's going to be. And now it's the end game. She's going to cancel Brexit. And that's when the people are going to have to rise up in the only way that in a democracy we can. And that is to stand behind a leader who has from the start warned us of these dangers, and who was the man who got us the Brexit referendum in the first place and made sure we voted the way we did. And that's to stand behind Nigel Farage and say, right, enough's enough. And the Conservatives, who really are Conservative, and that's most of them, they do not back Theresa May's faffing around and her incompetence on all this. They should now leave the Conservative Party, join the Brexit Party, and let us have democracy prevailing once again. Because the Labour Party is divided on this. They can't work out where they stand. You know, Corbyn, as a communist, doesn't like the EU, but although its structure is communist, it will stop him doing some of the wilder things he'd like to do here. So he's always been against the EU, and yet he's found himself having to campaign in effect on a Remainer ticket recently and say, oh, we must have another vote, etc., etc. But what we really need now is a party which is single-minded in saying we are going to get our democracy back, because that, in the end, is what this is all about. It's about, are we going to be a country where if the people take a decision to elect a government, that government then makes their laws? Or are we going to have a country, as we've had for the last 40 years, where it doesn't matter who the heck you elect in this country or in the European Parliament, the laws are only proposed by unelected commissars. The European Parliament cannot so much as bring forward a bill. Are we going to have democracy in any recognisable form, which the working people of this country like to have, or are we going to have a totalitarian dictatorship under the appearance of democracy, just as used to happen in the so-called people's democratic people's republics of Eastern Europe, which were in fact communist countries? And I think we need to get away from communism. We need to get back to democracy. And realistically, the only way to do that now, and it's very sad for me to have to say this, I used to work for the Conservative Party, I worked for Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative Party is no longer the way to get democracy back. We're going to have to start a mass movement outside the two major parties, outside all the existing parties, which simply says the people have spoken, their will shall prevail, and only the Brexit Party will make sure that there'll be no more nonsense. We will leave the EU, and then we can go back.
And leave would mean leave. Let me ask you this. I've always believed that the European Union, you go back as far as the Treaty of Rome, and the notion that it would be a place, a market for European countries even to trade in. Looking back, and I'm a history graduate, Christopher, I now don't believe that. I believe that the plan all along was for ever increasing political, fiscal and military union. And I've come to believe, not because I'm, in cloud cuckoo land, I don't think, but I've come to believe over the years that it's a major pillar of ultimately a one world government that would be controlled by the richest and most powerful companies in the world and financial institutions. I've always seen the EU as a major pillar of concentrating power in the hands of fewer and fewer people to make it easy to control states, nations and so on. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's true, isn't it? That's what it's been doing.
Well, there is a very, very large element of truth in that. This is the sad thing. One doesn't like to say, it's all a plot. But what one can say is that you now have increasing power, legislative power, being transferred from elected hands here in our parliament to unelected hands in the European Union, in the UN, in the world, in the Law of the Sea Conference, to the World Bank, to the IMF, international institutions, not one of which has a board which is elected by the peoples of the states parties to the treaties creating those bodies. So every time we transfer legislative power by treaty from our parliament to one of these, however worthy, international bodies, our democracy dies a little. And this is what's actually happening, because we have not stood up and said, we want the UN General Assembly to be elected by the peoples who belong to the UN. We want the board of the World Bank to be elected from among the member states who subscribe to it. We want the Law of the Sea Conference to be elected. If we don't do that, then every time we transfer power to them, and enormous amounts of power has been transferred to these international unelected elites by treaty over the years. And the you can look this up in the Foreign Office treaty series. You can see treaty after treaty after treaty transferring real power and wealth to the UN and the EU and all these other bodies. So we're not talking of a conspiracy here. You can read the treaties and weep. So we need to be very specific. We have by treaty handed away the power of our people to elect people who govern us directly to bodies overseas that we don't elect, but who do have the power over us to make laws that we have to comply with. The EU is one very good example of that. But this is indeed a growing and very dangerous trend. And I think one of the things that the Brexit Party should be standing for is to say that we will no longer pay money to or defer to or comply with the regulations and laws handed down to us by any international body unless the governing organization of that body is elected by us, the people of the states parties to the treaty that created that body. That's what's now got to happen. We have to have what on the left they call a process to get from this draining away of democracy through foreign treaties handing our power to legislate to people we don't elect somewhere else. We have to change that back, and we have to say it is no longer acceptable to have a so-called United Nations whose peoples are never consulted on who shall be their representatives there. We've got to make sure that democracy goes from the national to the international sphere, because you and I have grown up to realize that there are many subjects in an increasingly village-like world where it all belong to the same village, where we need to talk with other nations on how to do things. But if we're going to have those talks, and if we're going to give real legislative power and wealth to these organizations, then that power and wealth must be accountable to us via the ballot box. It's an old-fashioned idea, but it's time it was applied no less widely and no less certainly and no less vigorously and no less rigorously on the international stage and on the global stage as it has long been on the national stage in those countries, still a minority alas, where democracy is the norm rather than something that may one day happen.
Great, Christopher. Absolutely final question. We've got 30 seconds left. If Nigel Farage or somebody connected to him, I know you're connected to him.
Yeah.
If he picks the phone up and says, Christopher, I want you to stand, will you go back into politics?
Yes, I will. I'm not really fit enough, but somebody's got to. We cannot leave the country mired in the anti-democratic and irreformably anti-democratic EU. We tried to reform it in the Constitutional Convention. The commissars voted down and rejected every proposal that would have taken their power away and put it into the elected hands of the peoples of Europe. If we cannot make the EU democratic, we must leave. And if Nigel needs candidates to make that happen, then I will step forward.
Well, look, it was good chatting with you. It's always nice chatting with you, Christopher. Thanks. Listen, batten down the hatches. Horrendous weather incoming over the country, especially where you are, over the next 12 hours. So lock it down there. And we'll see how this plays out in the next few days. And I'm sure you'll be back on real soon. Thanks for coming on again.
All the best.
Cheers, Christopher. Christopher Monckton live on the line from his home there. Lots of tweets on that. A lot of people disagreeing with Christopher Monckton's assessment of Jeremy Corbyn and Jeremy Corbyn's relationships with Hamas and Sinn Féin and so on. I disagree with him. I couldn't have been clearer that I disagree with him. I think he's wrong, but that's his opinion. He's entitled to it. Jeremy Corbyn, you couldn't claim that Jeremy Corbyn is a threat to national security while the current Prime Minister is engaged in God knows how many countries around the world fighting proxy wars, murdering people with weapons slipped to jihadist groups and all the rest of it. It doesn't add up, but that's what he thinks. And people like Christopher Monckton think that way, and that's the way it is. It's coming up for 4 minutes to the top of the hour. Coming up real soon, John Wedger will be live on the show. The Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse is dealing with allegations around Westminster. This is hugely important. Alexis J, the fourth, I think, chair of the inquiry, overseeing that, hearing statements from victims, from people with evidence against establishment figures, political establishment figures. Want to get into that with John, and I'm looking forward to getting your comments on that as well. I know there's a lot of interest in that this evening. Diane, my friend from Ireland, from not far from Waterford, Diane says, Richie, Christopher really seems to know what's going on, yet he still believes in an establishment. I don't need anyone to run my life. For me, I'm doing quite well. People need to be left to their own devices. That said, we would have to have a real education system, says Diane. It is a contradictory thing, isn't it, with Chris? On the one hand, very much in favour of the establishment way of doing things, democracy. And on the other hand, he seems to understand, as he said to me back in November, and as he said today, that ultimately non-violent civil disobedience on a large scale might be the only way to get through to these people. Now, that's what I believe. So it's interesting. I think he's open-minded, to be honest. I think he's open-minded. Murray tweets, I totally agree with Monckton regarding democracy. Thanks, Murray, for that. Keep the tweets coming in. Hi to Sean. Hi to Mwinga, who said he doesn't agree with Christopher Monckton's Brexit rant. I don't agree, he says. Presumably, you don't agree where he was criticising Jeremy Corbyn. Fair enough. I don't agree with his comments about Jeremy Corbyn either. And I'm as far from being a Corbyn supporter as he could possibly get. Far too polarised an opinion, says Rich. All of the Labour Party ain't communists, excuse me. Rich says that Christopher's opinion is far too polarised. All of the Labour Party are not communists. Idiots, maybe, says Rich, but a broad spectrum of idiots. You're following, of course, Tom Watson meeting with more than 100 Labour MPs to form a party within a party. Isn't it funny how it's going, isn't it? It's going to be, the next couple of years, it's going to be the age of the centrist. And the media is really going to support this. You know, candidates who are very much of the social democratic mindset Blairites, you know, on the Labour Party, anyway, pretending to be on the left, Jess Phillips, right? Tom Watson and others, Yvette Cooper, you know, Blairites, we're on the left, we're socialists, no you're not. And they'll move further and further to the centre where they'll never really stand for anything except campaigning for what you can't say, what you can't think, that we must love Israel and all of that old garbage. That's what's coming down the line. So in the maybe not in the next election, but in the election after the next election, you might very well be looking at some sort of rainbow coalition forming a government in Westminster. It's absolutely ridiculous. By the way, keep those tweets coming in, please. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. My email is just not working. That's the email to the Richie Allen Show. I've meant to do something about that, but I've not managed to get around to it because I am being told by people, "Oh, I did send you an email, Richie." I just don't get emails sent to richie@richieallen.co.uk. A genuine apology for that, but I will work on it. The best way to get to me during the programme is to tweet me. And if you don't like Twitter, just make up some exotic name and go on there and send me a tweet during the programme and I'll read it out when it comes in. I think we've time for headlines. I think we do. Yeah, it's over to FSN in London where Ollie Barrett should have a very brief summary of the news.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Singapore and Australia have stopped all Boeing 737 MAX planes flying to and from their countries. UK MPs will vote later on a Brexit deal after changes were won by British negotiators. The US is reportedly warning Germany against cooperating with Chinese telecom company Huawei to build its 5G network, and the US is pulling all diplomatic staff from Venezuela, citing the deteriorating situation in the country.
Thanks very much, Ollie. Thanks, Patrick, for your tweet, by the way. Patrick tweets, "Richie, I have considered incompetence, poor decision-making, but conspiracy is probably the most plausible reason behind Theresa May's Brexit in name only effort. Sad state of affairs," says Patrick. Like I said, Patrick, I agree with that. Stephen tweets, "How you doing, Stephen? I agree with little of what Christopher Monckton says. Nevertheless, he is a great guest," says Stephen. Thanks, Stephen. "So long as the presenter is not sitting on his or her hands and not sticking their oar in." Sadly, commonplace in the so-called independent media today, he says, rather pettily. I am petty sometimes, but I don't care. I can be petty. Coming up for 2 minutes past the hour, this is your Richie Allen Show. It is live. It always is during the week on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk and TuneIn Radio. Got a terrific guest coming up for you in a few minutes' time. The whistleblower himself, former police detective John Wedger, talking about the IICSA hearings about Westminster. That is hugely important. If there's something you'd like me to put to John, do it through the usual Twitter handle. All righty then. Shall we move on? Let's move on.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Yeah, absolutely right. This is Twisted Sister on the Richie Allen Show. Back in two. Twisted Sister on the Richie Allen Show. We're not going to take it. The time is exactly 5 minutes past the hour. Right, this was in the Independent newspaper today. Thatcher protected Tory MP suspected of abusing children, MI5 files reveal. Didn't somebody call David Icke, right, many years ago, and said and wrote in his book that the very thing Margaret Thatcher protected Peter Morrison, Peter Morrison's alleged penchant for small boys was considered only in national security, not criminal terms, a witness tells the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse. An MI5 lawyer told the IICSA it was a matter of regret that the service considered only the national security implications of allegations of possible child abuse by Morrison, a Conservative MP for Chester, and did not pass the information on to the police. My next guest is no stranger to you. He's a retired police detective with over a quarter a century in service in investigating child abuse, and he turned up some stomach-churning things in his time as a police officer, helped expose abuse and protect victims of abuse. It cost him his job, really, you know, for covering up child prostitution rings. He works tirelessly now to expose it, working with victims and other campaigners looking for a change in the law to give whistleblowers protection. We've talked about this on the programme before. Let's welcome back to the programme John Wedger. John, welcome back, mate. How are you?
All right, Richie. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, mate. You know that this obviously comes as no surprise to you that lawyers chose not to pass on information to the police about Peter Morrison, but it must be sickening for people reading the Independent newspaper today who are only learning about this very high-profile MP, corridors of power, connected up to the wazoo. He was a paedophile. It was known that he was, but it wasn't disclosed to the police. What do you think?
Well, what's annoying is how many people have come forward and have exposed not just Peter Morrison, but people like Rose Boyce and, you know, and the other MPs that we're hearing about, and have been absolutely rubbished and laughed at.
Mocked, ridiculed. And we've seen victims, campaigns, I think you and I have spoken before, campaigns against victims, people who have come out and spoke about Edward Heath, people who have spoken about other people, some of them alive, ridiculed. National newspaper campaigns to dismiss their claims without any evidence that these people are not right or they're telling the truth. I believe they're telling the truth. I don't believe people come forward, you know, and risk wrecking their lives by making these allegations. What about the independent inquiry into child sex abuse hearings in Westminster, John? Do you want to update our listeners? What's been happening there? Because this is, I suppose, certainly, if it's not the crux of the inquiry, it's the most interesting aspect of the inquiry. What's been happening?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, I mean, I was a core participant and I was meant to be giving evidence in different strands. And at present, we're here in the Westminster strand. I've just had, funny enough, earlier on today, an email from the solicitors that deal with the core participants, and they're trying to get me to give evidence at the next one, which is to do with organised groups. But I was meant to give evidence here, and then after my statement was served, the ICSA, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, and it's just termed ICSA from the acronym of it, they took legal advice and got the parameters shut, so I wasn't able to give evidence. But the what we have heard, we've heard police officers and officers from the unit that I was on, and one of them, he just departed just as I joined the unit, one of the inspectors, Paul Holmes. I mean, they're basically giving a carbon copy of what I was saying. I mean, the only difference is I stood up and said, this is appalling, where I don't think they did. I mean, I'm not knocking them because we're hearing them stand up and speak out. But these police officers have got a duty to protect the public. And sort of closing your eyes and shutting your mind to this is not good enough. You've got to be a man and stand up and say, we're not having this, which is, you know, I don't want to take any glory, but which is what I did. But by God, I suffered for it. But what we've seen is that when I came forward in the early 2000s, it had been going on. And I think on previous interviews I've had with yourself and others, I've said for at least 15 years, no one had touched that. And that timeline matches perfectly with what we've heard today from the other officers that have been on the vice units and said we were told to shut our mouths and not to do anything.
Yeah, and I want to just endorse that. You know, John had the courage to stand up and report on the fact that children were being taken from care homes and abused and peddled, basically, you know, by flesh peddlers, by the lowest of the low. And John did do that, to your credit, and you're still doing it. Now, these police officers giving evidence at the Westminster strand of ICSA, they are saying that they were turning up evidence or coming across evidence against key political establishment figures, but then from on high they were told, well, forget about that, go and do something else. Tell us, is that what they've been testifying?
Yeah, I mean, what is interesting is that with me, it was, you know, a high-ranked officer, you know, not just told me to shut my mouth, but threatened me with the loss of my job, my children, you know, and everything else if I was to continue speaking out. So earlier on this year, I had a meeting with two cabinet ministers, both that had governance for policing and crime. And I expressed to them, one was Nicholas Hurd and one was Mike Penning. And I said, under what authority had this officer to threaten me with the loss of my job, my home and my children? He was obviously confident enough that he had the authority to say that and say that in front of a witness. And then when I reported it as corruption, both Operation Winter Keys and both the IPCC and later the IOPC failed to investigate it properly. And what I'm seeing now is they failed to investigate it. They probably did investigate it. But what was happening is that this senior officer was given license to do that. And we're seeing that now from the evidence of these police officers. Their senior management had license to cover this up. And we've now heard from MI5 this week, who were just saying that it was a national security risk. But I can't accept that because... you know, allowing
John,
someone...
John, let me jump in. This is really important. Was MI5 or was the MI5 witness asked to give a reason why it was a national security risk? Because if you were saying, look, we didn't pursue Morrison or pass on his name because there was a risk to national security, there couldn't be any justification for that.
Well, none whatsoever, especially when they know that this man is then going to go on to act with impunity and sexually abuse and probably rape other young boys. And these kids would have come from the care system. I mean, I did an interview with an incredibly brave man called Michael Taraga, who was who mentioned about the abuse that he suffered in the care homes. And one of the abusers when he got into his teens was Ted Heath. You know, and we're seeing that these kids are incredible. It's not just the damage physically that it does, and it does, it absolutely destroys them physically. It destroys their souls. I was given a report earlier on today from someone very high up in NHS mental health and just saying there is a significant link between mental health problems in adults with childhood sexual trauma. So we're just destroying these kids. So, you know, when we go back to the national security risk, one guy who was very much involved in exposing a lot of what's gone on, and I'd like to talk about this fellow in a minute if I can, he said to me, and when we were talking about it, I said, why would they keep information in the National Archives, which sometimes is referred to as the London Gazette, if it was that detrimental to national security? And he said, for one reason, John, it has blackmail value.
It has blackmail value. See, this is very interesting. So MI5 are saying it's an issue of national security. That's why we didn't prove, why we didn't do anything. But you've just introduced a brilliant, argument against that. Number one, the intelligence agencies could blackmail Morrison himself. But even if they weren't doing that, you could also make an argue that by not shopping Morrison, it is a national security issue because agents of Russia or some other country might get to him.
Well, the other thing,
you know,
is if we take their argument about national security, and I totally agree, and I think that's a crux of it. I went for a post in the police, and it was a high up intelligence job in which I'll be dealing with top security information. I was vetted to such a degree that I had to write down near enough every sort of financial dealing that I'd had of significance, and I had to give them details of every sexual partner that I'd had. And we had to have a briefing, a security briefing, prior to making these applications, these vetting applications for this job. And what was said to me was that if you have a past, which would be classed as being a bit dubious, like you're involved in swinging, orgies and things like that, there's a good chance with the digging we do, we're going to find out. And if we find out that you're not going to get the job anyway, if you at least tell us, we can sort of manage it. But a good chance you won't get it. But it's better that you tell us than we find out, and you could face discipline. And one of the things that was said to us is that, and this isn't politically correct, but it was what was said by the sergeant, was that they fail quite a few people that are homosexual because they have more sexual partners, and therefore there's more chance of them being subject to blackmail and coercion. Now, if we take that as a benchmark of how this works, when you take people like Ted Heath, that even when he was, you know, a minister, that he was hanging around well-known gay haunts like the Jack Straw's Castle, Hampstead Heath, and picking up underage boys. That information would have been known. There would have been protection officers. MI5 would have known about it. A lot of the street kids knew about it anyway. So if that's the case, then why wasn't he deemed a security risk to a degree that he was never given a job as Prime Minister? And you can say the same things about the allegations made against Leon Britton. You know, if that is what was happening, and I've heard a lot about the guy, then why was he given the job as Home Secretary when he would have been so easily blackmailed? And you can only think that they gave it to him because they wanted him to have that job because they can blackmail him, and they probably did.
I believe Edward Heath took the UK into the European, what was then the EEC, on very unfavourable terms to the UK, and I believe he was blackmailed into doing that. I really do believe that. Let's remind, I don't think I have the audio lined up. In fact, I don't at the moment. But what I can never understand is when the UK media is dismissing these notions that high-profile members of Parliament were and maybe are abusing boys, we'll never forget you or I, the late 90s documentary made by the BBC, when Edward Heath's chief whip, Tim Fortescue, said that everybody who knew anything came to the whips. If you had a problem, it could be something involving young boys. You'd come to the whips. Imagine that, coming out with that. It could be a problem with young boys. You would come to the whips and we would make it go away because then we would get you to do what we wanted in the future.
I mean, I can only go on how I know how extensive some of the policing, the intelligence side of policing was when it got to the covert side. And it was pretty much bang on. They were very, very good. Some of the infiltrators and the covert officers were very professional, very good at what they did. And then you take it a step further and you take the military intelligence units, and you're probably dealing with a tier higher than that. So they would know everything that was going on. And I knew about quite a few of the MPs because I was told, because I would go to intelligence meetings with a representative of Scotland Yard's paedophile unit, and we would openly discuss what was going on with PI, members of PI, and various MPs.
John Wedger is our guest. More than 25 years, a detective blew the whistle on children being used, taken out of care homes and being used as prostitutes, and much more besides. John has a website. I'll tweet a link out to it, johnwedger.com. Follow him on Twitter as well. You know, I'm talking to you now, and the BBC is updating its story on Medemsley Detention Centre all day long.
Keeps
updating the story. Hundreds of children were abused at a detention centre in Durham, and loads of officers have been convicted of abusing children there. Wherever you turn, you see this. Children in the care of the state, either as wards of the state because their parents can't look after them, or they're being kept in prison in the youth detention centres because they've infracted, they've had some, you know, they've broken the law. And what we see is through the last 5, 6, 7 decades, children going into these institutions have been abused. I've been asked to put this to you tonight by a number of listeners. I suppose some people think, well, it's 2019 now. That's in the past. Here's the question.
Yeah.
What about children in detention centres today in 2019?
Are they safe? Let's take this step by step. I mean, there was a film was made by Pymash Films. It was Forward Forever the Heroes. That was about the Medemsley home. And if you take, I think it's 1,500 kids have come forward from Medemsley as a result of the film. You're also seeing it with the Shirley Oaks. Now, the Beach Home and Beechcroft Children's Homes. Now, back then, these were big institutions, like the big Barnardo's homes. And it was all going to... Shirley Oaks had 19 known paedophiles working there. They were segregated the children into their religious backgrounds and into their ethnicity. So they would have the kids from the Caribbean homes in one place. You'd have the Irish kids in another place. They'd have handicaps. So it was a Disney world for these perverts. They were beaten on a daily basis. One guy that I interviewed was telling me about a care home he was in Essex, when all the boys from the age of 6 to 13 had to line up in the school hall naked in front of the girls that were in the homes. These are residential homes. The girls had to stand up and watch the humiliation while these boys were whipped and caned one by one, each one knowing what was going on every single night that happened at 6 o'clock. And then at night, they were dragged out of their beds and men were visiting the homes and they were raped and they were sexually abused. And that is not alone. That went on in all these homes. And when these kids, and there's something I would like to talk about one of the witnesses for the ICSA thing, and it ties in with what's going on.
Hey, John, just before you talk about this, I'm fascinated by this. I just want to make the point. I think you've already made it, but I want to make the point. If these boys are then being visited by men coming into these care homes, they're obviously men with money, John. They're men with means. It's not some scruffy guy. It's not some working class bloke like myself or like you who's coming from his council house to the care home to abuse children. It's obviously somebody who's paying for the privilege, right?
Yeah, well, of course. 100%. What we're dealing with, and you know, we've got to forget gun trafficking, drug trafficking, and all this. It's all minor stuff. The trafficking of children. Now, trafficking, let's not conjure up thoughts in our minds of kids being taken from the Far East and Thailand and Vietnam and Cambodia or even sub-Saharan Africa or Central America or whatever. It's not. Trafficking is a movement of a person for the purpose of crime from point A to point B. We have had it in our care institutions since they were built. And now one of the guys who was telling me about when he was taken by workers in the care home, right, to what was termed the meat rack, and that was in central London. It was a Wimpy Bar in Piccadilly, and he was picked up from the age of 6 onwards by men, and it was some nights it was multiple men, and he was anally raped by these guys night in, night out. Money was exchanged, and I said, can you sum up a typical client? And he said yes. They were all the what he called the Dirty Mac Brigade. He said they're all like senior civil servants, white middle class men that had money and they all smelt of tobacco. And he said near enough all of them were the same. Now if we go back to what I was saying about the care home, if these kids came forward, they were instantly deemed as a fantasist or a liar, and that went down on their records, right? And then they were whipped and beaten, and it would happen even more. So they were taught not to say anything. And what you'll see it with Medemsley, and I think it's called St. Peter's Mental Institution, is next door to Medemsley. And you see it in Jersey with the care homes there. You see it with children's homes everywhere. Like a court was always built next door to the police station, so it showed the geographical connection to these, as well as the connection behind the scenes. You saw it with these care homes, right? They were put next door was a mental institution because what happened? If they said anything, they got committed for life, you know? And that was the fear. That was a sword of Damocles. They held over these kids. If you say anything, you're going to end up in there. And I know that used to happen in Medemsley, you know, up in the northeast of the country. And they've done it time and time again. And the care staff were involved in it. The social services were involved in it, that there was medical matrons that were appointed to these care homes. These matrons and the doctors that would have come in these care homes, they would have been dealing with ruptured anuses, damaged intestine, colon.
Jesus fucking Christ.
They would have done time and time again. One of the guys was saying every night I shat the bed, defecated myself because my bowels were damaged, you know. So these nurses, so what I'm saying is when people speak out, where are the catering staff? They would have heard the rumours. Why are they silent? Why are the matrons silent? Why are the GPs silent? We need laws brought in that it's illegal to shut your mouths over this. Now, moving this forward into modern times, What I uncovered, again, was a racket. Although things had moved on a little bit and these big institutions had shut down. And from there, they'd gone into private concerns, a bit like old people's homes now, that you can buy it. You can get the Dalton's Weekly and things like that, and you can buy a business that is an old person's home or a children's home. And then they the owner gets paid a huge amount of money. We're talking £2,000 per week per child. You usually get about five kids, and then they're meant to be monitored, but they're not. Now, what I was seeing was that kids were going in there and they were being preyed on straight away. And other kids that were involved, they would get the new kids involved. They would get their friends involved. They would tell their friends, if you go home and say something about your parents, you'll get put in care. You can come in here. No one can touch you and you can start earning money with us. So everyone was coercing everyone else into it. And it was just a massive racket. And I can remember being told that in the borough of Haringey, where I was working at the time, you know, there isn't a problem with child prostitution. I got the list of the kids' homes. I rang up the first care home, almost as we're speaking, this is the timeline. And I said, how many kids have you got? They said, five. How many of them do you lose at the weekend? And I think you know what I mean. The guy says, I know exactly what you mean. He said, we lose three out of the five. So the majority of the kids were involved in prostitution straight away, and no one was monitored. No one cared about it. Now, what we've seen happen, Richie, I think they knew this was always going to explode, because mental health is a huge problem. And if we see, we can attribute so much of mental health to the sexual abuse of that young child. You know, we can see the recidivism criminality that occurs, which is costing this country billions upon billions. And nothing is done to get root cause of it, because it is child abuse. All of it comes down to child abuse. How many suicides, alcoholics, drug addicts are attributed to child sexual abuse? And I would say probably most of them.
There's no recovery from it. I wanted to ask you this. I've got no business asking this, as somebody who sometimes pompously thinks that he's a proper journalist. And well, I am. I'm going to be shot by some of my colleagues who know me well for asking you this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. We see thousands of children a year in this country taken into care for very spurious reasons. Yeah. Not necessarily because mum and dad are beating them up or because they are being sexually abused, but maybe because mum had an addiction at one time, or she had a problem at one time. And they introduced this wonderful term, risk of future emotional harm, which is a disgrace. I have begun to suspect, and listening to you, it's reinforced my suspicion that children, and I'm not saying that social workers are doing this deliberately, but there's something else going on behind the social workers. Children are being taken out and family courts are ordering the removal of children, and I think it's connected to the rape and the trafficking of children. I can't prove but I believe it.
It's huge business. And I spoke to one of the top criminal profilers that deals with child sex crimes and child sex murders in the world. She's on the FBI's top 10 list of profilers. And she's a Belgian lady. She's written many books about it. And she said, John, you've got to stop looking at the UK. This is global. These kids are trafficked from the UK. They end up in France, they end up in Belgium. And what you get is, once you cross borders, you're into a different legal system. We've got common law. They got Napoleonic law, so it's different then. And then different countries, the police won't talk to each other. There's a lot of arrogance. So these kids just get totally lost and they're gone forever. And we've seen that the big scandal was in Norway, where they were deliberately preying on children from Lithuanian families and taking them into care. And the parents were getting no recourse to any legal assistance. Now, I mean, one of the things I've got to state is that 80% of sexual abuse occurs within the home. So we've got to bear that in mind. There are kids that are taken into care because it's the safest place for them. However, they do prey, the social services, on families. And I think that there is a conspiracy to take kids that don't warrant it into care. It's big business. It's huge money to be earned on it. There was a barrister. It happened to her. She got a child that she was adopting. And they took the child off her, and it was social workers that end up taking the kid into foster placement. and the social workers were the foster carers themselves. So they were doubling up not only as social workers during the day, they had this other job which was extremely well paid for as foster carers, and they can pick and choose whatever kids they want.
Hang on a second, this is a bombshell. I've never heard of this. So you have come across at least one case where social workers who intervene in crisis situations in families also earn money by fostering children?
Yep. And they can pick and choose what children they want. I mean, there's a couple of people that I not only work with but I've spoken to that they never got put in the foster system because these were like angry wild dogs. And they said, no one could control us because of what we've been through, you know. And of course, no foster parent wants a child like that that's going to kick off. So they'll pick the placid one. And this is one of the things I've been saying as well. We've got such a broken society. We've got single parenting that is rife. We've got dysfunctionality everywhere. And they prey on this. And what I would say to people, please keep your family strong to the best of your ability. Because when you marriages break up and everything else, your kids are the ones that suffer because you become vulnerable as a family unit.
You say, John, they prey on it. They do, but the system manufactures it. The system creates the environment in which people struggle to stay together. You know, people...
Of course, this is 100% it. Agree. Yeah, I think they've done it through various means. I mean, one of the things I want to get onto is a bit of legislation that I came across years ago. I used to do specialist interviewing, and because of my ability at doing it, I was asked to teach... interview skills and specialist interview skills for 2 years to detectives. And there was a bit of legislation that came out in 2003, the Criminal Justice Act, and part of it was in relation to bad character. And it was seen as a brilliant thing to bring in. And it was really, they concentrated on domestic violence and robberies to sell this act, to saying that someone has got a propensity and previous convictions for a said offence, like robbery, like burglary, it can be brought in to the trial. Before they had to use it at the very end in sentencing, they'll say, well, this person has got 50 previous. And they sold it through the robbery stuff and through domestic violence. Because they said, this guy is, in doing the trial, he's been violent towards women in the past, he's got a history of it. And it was seen as a just thing to do and a step forward in fair play. But there was more of a nefarious thing to this, because if you've come from an abused background and then you self-medicate, started off with alcohol and then it progresses to the opiates, you know, heroin and what have you, to fund that, you're going to, if you're a man, you're going to shoplift. If you're a woman, you're going to do street prostitution. On the whole, I'm generalizing here, but it's just for the sake of this argument, you know, and of course, you know, you're going to get away with 90% of it. But you're going to get caught at some point. So you get caught shoplifting. You're deemed then as a person of dishonesty. And at some point, you know, yesterday's victim is going to become tomorrow's witness. At some point, they knew that there's going to be an explosion. These people are going to start coming forward, which is what we're seeing now. And straight away, you're going to get a victim of abuse come forward, name their perpetrators, and they're going to get attacked straight away as a person of dishonesty.
An unreliable witness.
But wow. One of the things that they've got to say is that offence has to be within time and it has to be relevant. And that can be argued. Now, what we saw at the ICSA hearings this week was a very integral witness came forward, and it was a man called Chris Fay who had supplied the list of the Elm guest house, which had included people like Cliff Richard, Leon Britton, and various other people. They had to go out their way to discredit this guy, and they said this man cannot be relied on because he's a fraudster. Now, Chris had come from the care system, like all the others, and had got involved in petty crime. He'd gone on to become a social worker, done very well, a senior social worker and a local authority councillor. But he went away for an employment matter of fraud because he'd stolen some money from work. Now, that was then used to prevent him giving evidence in his capacity as a social worker and exposing child abuse cover-ups. My argument here is it's got no relevance. It's got absolutely nothing to do with his credibility as a witness. But they had to demonise this guy because he's the one that was the bridge linking this list of Elm Guesthouse that came out. However, in a matter of fairness,
I don't think it's reliable, John. It is. I don't think the Elm Guesthouse list, if I can say that, Elm Guesthouse list is reliable. I mean, Cliff Richard would say, I don't care who says my name was on a list. I was never there. I didn't do any of that. There's no evidence I was anywhere near the place, he would say.
Well, in a matter of fairness, they revoked Chris Fay's core participant status. However, Harvey Proctor has been granted core participant status, and allowed to give evidence. Now, if we look at Harvey Proctor, he's got a conviction for a sexual offence, you know, on young men. You know, okay, they were 17 and upwards, but he was convicted of an offence, a sex offence of gross indecency.
I hear what you're saying. By the turn of events and the new laws, Proctor should be considered to be an unreliable witness.
Oh, without a doubt, you know, and he was then cited under Operation Midland. His house was searched, and also again, Mike Bill then, earmarked him for investigation as well.
But John, do you know what? The establishment is so cute and so evil and so sinister. I don't believe that Proctor abused boys. I believe that Proctor was used as a sort of a patsy because they knew the claims would eventually fall apart. Then they could say, well, all the claims against politicians and members of the establishment are bullshit. You understand what I'm saying, don't you? They make false claims against people deliberately so that they can disprove them and then say, well, look, it's all a big hoax anyway. I think they use people who are innocent, accuse them, to protect the legions that are guilty. It's just my opinion.
Well, I mean, you used to see it a lot with crime scenes. You would get people deliberately turn up at a crime scene and contaminate it. Yeah. So when they were arrested, they can say, well, of course, I walked across the crime scene. And you used to get a lot with the Trident, the black-on-black shootings, you know, back in the 90s, that quickly getting there and deliberately contaminate the crime scene. But what I'm on about is fairness.
Yes.
You know, what is fair? Now, we've got 635 MPs. A lot of them never heard of, but it's the same MPs whose names keep cropping up consistently, all the time. You know, an MP can get convicted. As long as they don't spend more than a year in prison, they won't be removed from post. And even when they do get out of prison, they can apply to get their old job back. There is no obligation for an MP to tell their employer, the House of Commons, that they've got a conviction.
And it, say that again. This is mind-boggling stuff. John Wedger is our guest. Served as a detective with distinction, blew the whistle on the rape of children who are peddled around in, used as prostitutes, taken out of care homes. Following ICSA, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, they're talking about Westminster. Tell me this, you've lost me there. So if a sitting MP is under the new law because they're trying to introduce legislation that says that the accused won't be named, at least at the outset anyway. Help me out here. Are you saying that somebody could be convicted of child abuse, but keep that conviction sub judice, suppressed, and then go back to work? How would that work?
Yeah, well, and right, there's a thing called the Representation of the People's Act 1981, and it's an MP can only be disqualified from their parliamentary seat if they're detained in a prison in the UK for more than a year.
Right.
Right. There is no obligation for an MP to tell their employer, which House of Commons, that they have a conviction. All right. And now we've got 635 MPs. We've got 29 of them that have been accused of domestic violence. We've got 9 that were under investigation for fraudulent checks. We've got 3 that have gone to prison for assault. We've got 8 that have been arrested for shoplifting. 14 arrested for drug offences and 84 been arrested for drink driving, and they're still at work.
Wow, yeah. Most recently that daft cow in the Labour Party who lied about being behind the wheel. Maybe I shouldn't refer to her as a daft cow, but she's a daft cow. Right, so, yeah, but look, if an MP is arrested on suspicion of abusing children and if that goes to court, we're going to know about that, right?
Well, you'd like to think so because, you know, at some point it will go to court and it will be in the public domain and therefore, hopefully it will get out. But one of the things which was really annoying was that in the last week's hearings at the ICSA, down in Southwark in Pocock Street, there was one member of the press, and that was Mark Watts, who was part of Exaro. There was no mainstream media there at all. And I walked, on that day, I did a video footage of the different locations in London where children were pimped out. And on the way there, there was some sort of press release at a hotel, and there was a few celebrities. There was press all outside it. But when it came to the ICSA thing, not one member of the press there. This is probably one of the most important trials that we've had, you know, court hearings, proceedings, whatever it is, inquiries that we've had so far. Nothing on the mainstream media. Absolutely nothing.
Just the Independent today. To be fair to the Independent, they've gone with the story about Morrison and MI5. But you're right, in general, I'm going to say you're right. You've got a very good point, up to a point. It's not getting coverage. I know it isn't. I know the tabloids are not really paying any attention to it, and the tabloids are far more widely read than the Independent, which is no longer in print. It's only online. So I'm going to give you that one. They're not reporting on it. They should have dozens of people there in the press gallery, day in, day out, reporting on this, and yet they're not. Wow.
But what we're doing now is that I've got a great little media team with me, and we're putting things straight out on Twitter and on Facebook. You know, there was one I put out the other day, and within 3 days, got 300,000 hits. In the last 2 weeks, we've had 680,000 hits. And this isn't the alternative media. I think this should be termed the new media, because this is where people are taking notice. Facebook and Twitter is a very, very powerful medium indeed.
Well, you're bypassing the print media if they're not going to do it. You know, and if you've got 680, nearly 700,000 hits on something, it's far more than the Daily Mail sells newspapers in the UK. They won't sell 500,000 newspapers tomorrow. That's good stuff.
Well, I'm in contact with Mike Veal, you know, the former chief constable of Wiltshire, and then Cleveland, who sort of was the instigator of Operation Conifer, which was looking into Ted Heath.
Courageous man.
A very good man. And, you know, it was late last year, there was a massive attempt by the Daily Mail to destroy him over a mobile telephone. And it was in a moment of rage, he'd hit his golf bag with a club and broken his mobile phone. And they used that to say that this man cannot be trusted, therefore, because he's broken his mobile phone, and there was discrepancies in his official report on what actually happened over a mobile phone, that he could not be trusted when it comes to giving evidence about Ted Heath and the abuse and the rape of young boys.
Let's remind our listeners, John Wedger is our guest. He's talking about Chief Constable, Superintendent, I should say, Mike Veal, very courageous man, Wiltshire Police. He headed up Operation Conifer, which looked into allegations against former UK Prime Minister Edward Heath. After an exhaustive investigation properly done, and while he was doing it, he was being hammered by the press while he was doing it. Some of the newspapers should have been charged with perversion of the course of justice, because while he was doing this, and while he hadn't made any conclusions, they were trying to bring him down and denigrate him and ridicule him. And Mike Veal concluded in his report, after an exhaustive investigation, that the claims against Edward Heath were credible, and if Edward Heath was alive today, he would be facing charges. That's who he is. That's who John is talking about. Go ahead, John. Sorry about that.
Again, they bring people to their knees. And I said, you know, he was the chief constable. He was at the very top. And for a man of that level to be as moralistic as he is, I mean, it's fantastic. And I said to him, the attack on me came from people of your rank, from ACPO level rank. I said, who's attacking you? And he said, certain elements of the House of Lords and MI5.
MI5, wow.
And MI5, you know. And so then when we look at that, you think, what are MI5 here for? If they're allowing, you know, these backbenchers and these ministers to act with total impunity when it comes to the rape and sexual assault, mainly of young boys, what is their purpose? It's a very nefarious purpose. And what are we doing about it as a nation? Nothing. You know, people just don't care. This is an attack on the very essence of humanity, an attack on our children. And how can our lawmakers even point the finger at us in judgment when they're allowing, you know, their work colleagues to act unabated in such an evil and vile manner? It just it goes against every grain of decency and humanity.
It certainly does. In the last couple of minutes we have, do you still have any trust or any faith in the process and Alexis J? Do you think there's a real genuine effort?
Not in that thing at all. You know, evidence is going to get heard, but I'm sorry, but I just feel it's going to be a whitewash. And, you know, I've sat before quite a few ministers now, and all they say is, you know, the ICSA thing, like it's going to sort everything out, like it's Zorro up here and it's going to clean it all out. And, you know, I'll give you an example, Richie. I sat in quite a high profile meeting with members of the Home Office. There was five members of the Home Office. There was Nicholas Hurd, the MP for Policing and Crime, and then there was a former MP for it, Mike Penning. And what was said to me by Nicholas Hurd, he said, John, about whistleblowing and how it's important that, that police officers are protected. He said, but we have legislation that prevents the attack on whistleblowers. And I said, Nick, there is legislation that prevents people from having sex with children, but they still do. And it was such a naive thing for them to say that because there's legislation, there's nothing to see, people don't do it. And this is how they're not on the same level of reality as us. The only good thing about the meeting was Mike Penning actually stood up and he said to Nick Hurd, I was deliberately removed from my post as policing minister because I stood by John Wedger. Right? He said, John, you wouldn't be sat here now if I hadn't stood by you. You take that any way you want. And that was quite comforting words, although it was quite frightening words.
Frightening words, you know, but you've got to be, that's got to give you some optimism because you mentioned Mike Veal there. There are other men and women who've worn the uniform, Maggie Oliver and others, who have the courage like you. Okay, there are not, there aren't 500 John Wedgers, sadly, but there's a few dozen. There's a few dozen.
Well, yeah, they are. And, you know, we're in touch with each other. You know, Maggie, there's another lad called Pete Jackson, there's that brave guy Lenny Harper, you know, and hopefully that, you know, we'll all be an inspiration to make others come forward and to stop the government from bullying us into silence. But one of the other things is I interviewed a guy that was a victim of the abuse by Ted Heath, and he gave a fantastically powerful interview. He's written a book which we are selling. It's called The Meat Rack Boy. We're selling it via Amazon to raise funds for our campaign. But we've now come under attack by Private Eye magazine, and they're sending investigative journalists onto us to try and discredit us because we're actually now getting a voice and we're getting credibility and we're getting popularity. So Private Eye magazine at the moment are sort of doing their best to try and knock us down. You know, but if it comes, it comes. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I'll still carry on breathing, and actually, I won't be bothered. You know, but this is how the, and you've got to look at by their actions shall you know them, as it says. You know, why would anyone want to cover this up? Why would any parliamentary minister want to cover up his colleague? Why the hell would MI5 want to cover this up? You know, it's evil and it's wrong and it's not why we pay our taxes, and they have to be held accountable. And we cannot accept the same old rhetoric that they keep giving us. We've learnt mistakes, we've moved on. We haven't learnt mistakes. We saw it from the brave officers that gave their testimony last week. What was going on in the 80s and 90s was still, according to my testimony, going on in the 2000s. And when I was removed, I got it then from someone high up in the senior management team in 2012, that they never, in the Met Police, they never investigated another case of child prostitution when I was removed from post in 2006. So for nearly seven years, they never even bothered looking at it. And
I
that's
think
not good enough.
It's not good. I think there's a day of reckoning coming for them. John is on Facebook. There's only one John Wedger. That's J-O-N. and it's WEDGER. He's on Twitter. It's at @Wedger_John on Twitter. But if you can't find that, you should be able to @Wedger_John. Go to my Twitter. I've tweeted John a bit in the last couple of days, so you'll find him there. Follow him on Twitter. And the website is johnwedger.com. I think there are a lot of people. I think a lot of people might, you know, I think they do today. I think in the future we'll owe a big debt of gratitude to people like you, because I do believe a day of reckoning is coming. John, the lid is off this now, mate. Final word to you. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm just saying that I'm now getting quite a good following now, and I'm over the moon about that. I've been asked to mention something. There is a group that have come to me. There's a little syndicate, a network. We heard about PI, you know, the paedophile information exchange and everything else that was going on. But we still got things going on now. There is a group that is setting up naturist days at local swimming pools throughout the UK. And it's open to the public. So we're encouraging children, naked children and members of the public, unchecked to come. And it's, you know, things like this have to, we need to stand up and say no. We need to be protesting against it. We need to be getting on to our local police, local authorities, and stopping all this from going on, because it's vile.
It's vile, mate. Yeah, I saw that in the Daily Mail. I couldn't believe it. I had to look at it again. Listen, you know you're welcome back anytime. When you've got anything to share with us, just give us a bell and come back on. @Wedger_John on Twitter. He's on Facebook, and it's johnwedger.com. More power to you, John. Thanks again, mate.
No, it's an absolute privilege. And if I could just push the Meat Rack Boy, and it's available on Amazon, please buy a copy. All the money will go onto our campaign, and it will go on to help victims and survivors. And we're doing quite a lot of that now. So thank you so much, Richard.
Not at all. Get onto Amazon, the Meat Rack Boy. Get onto Amazon.com and support whistleblowers and investigators like John Wedger. You're welcome, pal. Thanks a lot. We'll speak again real soon. John Wedger there. On the line to us this afternoon, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse is dealing with the Westminster strand of the investigation right now, and has been hearing testimony from victims, survivors, but also from police officers who are coming forward. And okay, you can berate them for not speaking up at the time, but I'd rather we thank them for coming forward now and saying, well, yes, we knew that a certain high-profile politician was raping children, but we were told from on high not to continue with the investigation. I think we should pat them on the back rather than lament the fact that they didn't feel they could speak out at the time. That's just my opinion, you know. The fact they're speaking out now is, I think, is very important. I really do. I won't be with you because... Don't panic. I'll be with you tomorrow for 2 hours. No, I was just going to say the vote on May's revised deal, she says it's revised, but it isn't. It's the same old crap with some different wording. Her revised withdrawal agreement with the European Union will be voted on by MPs at Westminster sometime in the next 10 to 15 minutes. I'll be gone then because this programme is about to wrap up, but I'll keep you up to date with it, maybe on social media, and I'll certainly be talking about it briefly tomorrow. I am mindful of the fact that this audience, while I don't have millions of listeners, I wish I did, but I do have hundreds of thousands of listeners, and they're scattered all over the world, and a lot of people are pissed off at Brexit. So while there will be reflection on the result tomorrow and the implications of it, and so on, so on, I'm going to try and stay away from a long-winded reflection tomorrow on this vote, as important as this whole issue is, because I can sense the fatigue amongst this audience and also amongst pretty much everybody else. People are just sick to death of that. A big shout-out to Christopher Monckton, who came on the programme earlier on, wound quite a few of you up with his opinions on Jeremy Corbyn and socialism and communism. I did put your points of view to him, though. That's what it's all about, isn't it? A debate. Patricia says, Richie, thanks for the show with John. His courage to come forward with the truth about child abuse is much respected. If only more people would, there might be hope to stop this horrendous situation going on everywhere in the world. Amen to that, Patricia. We'll finish on that positive note. Right. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Listen, the weather's going to be horrendous overnight in the UK. Be careful. Lock it all down. Wrap up tight. See you tomorrow. Once upon